Hi, Sam.
Oh, hi, Simon. Or should I say, Explorer Dingle?
Why would you? Oh, because of my challenge. I mean, I did feel a little bit like Dora the Explorer this week.
Oh, cute. I'm so excited to hear about it. I feel like you've come back from the wild with cool specimens to show us.
Well, let's dive straight into it. So your challenge that you set me in our last episode, as I record it, was to go into the wild, like Dora the Explorer, and to find an organism.
Yes.
Preferably one I wasn't already familiar with.
Correct.
And then first to observe and spend time in nature with this organism, then to name it, and then to find out a bit more about what it really is, right?
Yeah. Exactly.
Okay. So, as with your last challenge, I'm throwing this back at you. No, I'm joking. I actually did do this. I actually went out into nature to my favorite swimming spot and noticed a very strange little fish in the waters of the Atlantic off Cape Town.
Oh, my goodness. Oh my goodness.
That is kind of translucent, super small. I want to say like 5 centimeters long.
Amazing.
And looks like it's struggling when it's swimming. Like it doesn't look like it's swimming. It looks like it's leopard crawling through the water.
Oh,
at least that's how it looked to me. So the first thing I did was try and take a photo of it, which, I mean, talk about exercises in futility.
Because
this thing is skittish and tiny and translucent.
Amazing.
Or at least it looks translucent. So that didn't work. And then I went and consulted with my good friend and fish expert, GPT. And after some back and forth, we decided... Oh, wait, I should give you my name for it first, right?
Yes.
So I decided to call it a sicklefish.
Oh, man. Oh, nee.
Which, for anyone of you who doesn't speak Afrikaans, directly translates to struggle fish, although it doesn't sound
cute.
As good in English.
Yeah, it's cuter. It sounds much cuter.
But what it really is probably a Cape Silverside. This is what GPT and I have concluded. It does have a Latin name. Actually, let me look up its Latin name. It'll surprise you to learn that I haven't memorized it. Atherina breviceps. And these little guys, there's not much to say about them. Its Wikipedia page is about 240 characters.
Incredible. But I think I'm more interested in like your observations of the fish.
So they typically are only found sort of in, I can't remember, I'm not very good with the taxonomy of water bodies, but like inlets into the ocean, so not in the bright blue ocean itself.
Mm.
But the spot I love swimming at is sort of very rocky and forms almost like a little bay with the rocks.
Mm.
So it's very enclosed and safe, and that's probably why they were there.
Wow.
And I try to find out whether or not they're endangered. They definitely aren't considered endangered because basically nothing except other fish like eating them will give a shit about them. However, they are very important for the marine ecology because bigger fish need to eat smaller fish or something like that.
That is
and
magical.
That's it. That's what I got for you, Sam. I did
that's
spend some
magical.
Time in the water with my iPhone standing very still trying to take photos of them. Because they would come and sort of flock around me. But anyway, not being a fish photography expert myself, that didn't go so well.
Do you know what? There's something kind of magical about this because I think this comes down to the question of like, how do you describe something to someone who has never seen the thing you're describing, right? So I get such a vivid picture in my head when you say the word sicklefish. You know, you're like semi-translucent, tiny sicklefish. There's no photograph you could show me that would be as kind of distinctive as that word picture you've just painted. That's magic. Words are cool. Words are a great technology.
It did also make me realize how many organisms there are around us that we don't think about because they're not the one we're trying to catch or they're not the one that's on our plate or they're not the one that has the cute babies that's, you know, aren't too far removed from our cute babies. But that are, you know, important parts of the scene that you just never really stop and think about.
Especially, I mean, the sea is such an alien place, right? Like you spend much more time in the ocean than I do, especially these days. And I mean, I always feel slightly afraid in the ocean, partly just because I think that's the rational emotion to have about the ocean. But it is the sense of it's totally alien, and there are these things that you just don't, you know, there are snakes, there are things you can't see. How did you feel meeting the Silclefus? How did it make
not
you
scared,
feel?
I'll tell you that much. this little 5-centimeter motherfucker did not scare me, let me put it that way. But it is so interesting, because I find, you know, if I'm doing something on the water, so if I'm kayaking or I'm surfing, or I'm just swimming above, you know, with my head above the water, there's kind of this unknown below you, and that does kind of make you feel a little bit of out of place and a bit scared. The moment you get your head under the water, so if you're free diving, I've never really scuba dived, but, you know, the moment you get under the water and you're in the scene, all of a sudden it's not scary at all. You're just, you know, part of everything that's happening below the water, and the stuff above it doesn't bother you because, you know, that's where you come from. So it's a completely different and magical world. Even if you're just spending, you know, a minute or two underwater when you're free diving, with your mask on, the moment your head's under the water and you're in a kelp forest, or you all of a sudden, even these large fish that are very scary as shadows beneath you, they lose all of that kind of, I don't know, ominous, and they just become part of the scene, and you realize that they're not that concerned with you at all.
That's amazing. Have I ever told you about Elsie Bostelman? Did we talk about this in a previous episode? I can never remember what we've spoken about.
Well, since we do one a year and we've been doing them for 12 years, I'm going to go with maybe.
Probably. At some point.
And since I can barely remember what I had for breakfast.
What I love about her, so she, you know, the bathysphere, those like round, like iron submarine things that they would put people in to go and explore the deep ocean. So in some of those early expeditions, Elsie Bostelman, she was a painter, and basically they brought her along on the expeditions because they had the bathysphere that would go down into the deep ocean. You can't reach your hand out of the bathysphere because it's pressurized and like grab a, if you see like a weird ass fish, you can't grab that fish and then bring it up and be like, look at this weird fish, right? You have to go down to the deep ocean, or you had to back in the early days of deep ocean exploration, look at the weird fish, and then come back up and be like, okay, I'm going to describe the weird fish to you, and this is kind of how, this is all I can do. And Elsie Bostelman never went inside the bathysphere. She never went down into the deep ocean. She was on, because, you know, it was days when women as explorers and women as scientists was still kind of, you know, kind of was, they were hampered. So she would sit on the boats on the ship, and the bathysphere would come up, and the people in the bathysphere would describe the fish to her, and she would paint them. And she made these unbelievably vivid, beautiful paintings of creatures she'd never actually seen with her own two eyes, sort of like a police identikit, where she would have to be like, okay, like this or like this, you know? And they're just unbelievably evocative. And now that we have got like photographs and things of these fish, many of them are also incredibly accurate. I think there's just something really, really interesting about that question of how do you, I don't know, this kind of like, how do you visualize something that's totally alien, you know? And she's just someone who kind of did that for us, which is in a way that
I mean, my mind is just blown at the fact that these anyway resembled real organisms. Because I don't know that much about bathyspheres, but they had like a tiny little really thick glass window that, you know, these presumably men of the ocean were looking at these fish through. So, we were already starting with a pretty hazy visage of whatever they were looking at,
God,
which they then described on their rum breath to a lady on a boat who managed to make accurate drawings. How is this possible?
So cool, I know. And then it was sort of nuts. So, like, I think last Monday I went to a talk at the Royal Institute. This is one of my favorite things about living in London, is there's just so much nerdy shit going on, you know. And people talking about it. I went to this talk by the director of, I think it's called the Schmidt Ocean Institute. And they basically do deep sea exploration now. And they have this vessel that's kind of going around the world now, mapping the kind of deep ocean floor. And they have this little, it's kind of like a drone, but under the water. It's not called a drone. I can't remember what it's called. It's like an autonomous vehicle sort of thing. And it can go down into the deep ocean and live stream 4K footage. And it was interesting because she was talking about how the vessel launched, was due to launch in 2020. And it did launch. And it was kind of one of the pieces of exploratory science that could continue during the pandemic, because they were just scientists sitting at home watching the live stream videos, kind of like discovering, I think they've discovered like 4,000 new species or something, from scientists mostly working at home. They don't even have to be on the vessel. And these little submersible machines, whatever they're called, I really should have taken better notes. they have all these sensors on them. They can even do things like she was describing. They can take samples of the water. They can test the DNA of little skin cells and scale cells, I suppose, that are in the water. And they can tell from that what species of fish have swum through that area in the past, like unbelievably detailed. And I just think about, 150 years ago, there were people in their little bathyspheres kind of describing the weird stuff they were seeing at the bottom of the ocean. And now you have this kind of like live, live stream from the bottom of the sea. And they're still discovering so much stuff down there. Like, we just don't know anything about what's actually going on in the bottom of the ocean. It's nuts.
Well, it's mind blowing that we're discovering new species both above and below the ocean all the time. And actually, GPT didn't render a very large list of potential tiny, slender, translucent fish off the coast of South Africa. It turns out that if you Google this, there aren't that many lists of these things. Like, if you look for websites that help you identify fish, like fully 100% of them are devoted to fishermen who are not fishing for, little tadpole-sized things. And it makes you wonder how many of these species have ever even been considered, or just things that like kids occasionally catch with their nets off the, in a rock pool somewhere.
And there's obviously such disparity, species that are endemic, like to the coast of Africa, for example. It's kind of like in general information about, like global south systems or so, like that thing about how on Wikipedia, I think fewer than 1% of articles or something are written by African editors. Crazy like that. Yeah, absolutely. The one thing they were talking about, the ocean people, which kind of really hit me, was because we're getting to this point now, specifically with the ocean, which I find absolutely terrifying, where they're talking about doing deep sea mining. And they're talking about starting to really disrupt ecosystems that we know absolutely nothing about. So they were talking about how there was this place in the mid-Atlantic that had been kind of earmarked as a potential site of mining exploration, because there were a bunch of hydrothermic vents there. And they were like, nothing lives in those kind of systems because they're too hostile. But by the way, we've never actually really gone and looked. We just, of course, nothing lives there. And so, of course, they send this little vehicle, which is called the Falkor, which I love, down, and they look and like, if you go and look, there are like, it's teeming with life, like these weird hairy crabs and stuff, And that's what kind of freaks me out, is that, these things are so underknown and disappearing.
Well, at least they're giving it more thought than Kim Jong-un does every time he decides to test a nuclear missile off the coast of Japan, just wipes out like how many trillion organisms.
Making Godzillas left and right. Have you seen the new Godzilla movie, by the way?
I have not. Should I?
My God, it's good. It's so good. It's so, so, so okay. good. I mean, because Godzilla is all about, it's a nuclear parable, right? But it's, this is such a good one. Yeah.
Anytime you describe something as good, 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 you are guaranteed that I will see it.
Look, the main reason I specifically think you should see it, this is a bit of a spoiler for anyone who hasn't seen the movie, but the hero of the story, apart from Godzilla, obviously you're on Godzilla's side because it's very cool when Godzilla goes and smashes buildings, but the hero of the movie are tugboats. There's a fleet of tugboats that save the day. What? And you know how you and I feel about tugboats, Simon? Team tugboat.
Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Are there any gay tugboats?
I mean, I didn't ask. Doesn't come up.
That would be the ultimate spoiler alert.
Tugboats.
If the hero of the Godzilla movie was a homosexual tugboat, that would make me so happy.
Be truly the best. Tugboats truly are just like the most incredible technical achievement of the human species.
Oh, man. What things we have wrought through science.
Badness, but okay, also we're not, tugboats.
We're not going to go into our history of tugboats. I'm sure that we've discussed that before. I mean, I can't be entirely sure, but...
who knows what we've discussed, Simon.
Okay, but when when you set me this challenge of wandering into nature like Dora the Explorer, what were you thinking about at the time? Just that it would be funny.
I thought it'd be funny. No, that's good enough for me. Yeah, I've been thinking a lot about climate grief recently. So, my kind of like oldest friend Milani, she and I every year since we were 12. We've done this thing where we sit down and we try and like set an intention for the year. And, you know, when we sat down over Christmas this year, I went first and I had the incredibly mundane goal. I was like, I want to take more photos of my life. I feel like I take no photos. And, you know, then I look back on the year and I've got like 3 photos of which are just like photos of my electricity meter, you know, and I'm like, I love my life. I actually should document it all. It's cute, but it's like pretty banal. And then I asked her what her main kind of goal for the year was. And she was like, I really want to kind of let myself truly feel climate grief and use that grief to motivate myself to live more thoughtfully. And I was like, oh, damn, that's a very different level of goal. But I've been reflecting about that a lot, right? Like to what extent is it helpful to kind of feel the feelings of loss about kind of, you know, the incredible world that we live in, which I think also it's so connected to loving, you know, the world that we're in. And I've also obviously been thinking about it a lot because I'm homesick because it's the middle of blooming winter here and it's miserable. And all of you guys back home, just, you know, it's height of summer and I miss you all. But I also really miss Cape Town, the place, that kind of richness. So... yeah, I think that's kind of what has motivated the challenge which you have risen.
That's quite sad. Yeah, I'm not familiar with climate. I mean, I guess I am. I mean, you think of climate change and you think of activism, but to think of it through the lens of grief is quite interesting. Yeah. It reminds me of, have you read Douglas Adams' Last Chance to See book?
I know of it, but I haven't read it. Yeah.
It's far and away... Yeah, it's far and away the best thing he ever wrote, as far as I'm concerned, because it was nonfiction, and I think other than articles, it's the only piece of nonfiction. Well, it's the only nonfiction book he wrote that I'm aware of. But he wrote it with this absolute passion for these animals and for wildlife, and basically, what Last Chance to See was, it was a documentary and a book where he traveled around the world with another guy whose name escapes me. Documenting animals that were on the verge of extinction. And this book came out, if I remember correctly, in the 80s. So, you know, when you read it now, it's quite poignant because a lot of those animals that were about to be extinct, like the Yangtze River dolphin, for example, are now extinct. Mm-hmm. And species of lemur in Madagascar. And but being Douglas Adams, he manages to, portray that grief and that dismay in a very funny way, you know, because he was he was a deeply funny man, but also was able to use humor as a tool to make you realize things, which all great comedians can, I guess. So highly recommend reading the book. I've never watched the documentary series, and in fact I think they recreated it recently with Stephen Fry. I might have dreamed this. Maybe I should Google it. but definitely worth seeing.
That sounds wonderful. Yeah.
They're remaking the documentary, it seems, with Stephen Fry.
With Stephen Fry. Shush, that sounds so good. So up my alley. Yeah. I mean, I think that's it, right? Like I've engaged a lot intellectually with the, you know, kind of the polycrisis and climate change in the last few years. And I sometimes end up kind of in this really befuddled place, you know, where you feel kind of stymied because you think you're talking about changing some of the most kind of complex systems of human society and economics and how we work, you know, to kind of deal better with the the complex systems that we're disrupting ecologically. But I think what I've been kind of maybe holding at arm's length a little bit is kind of just that really, the grief, I guess, just of, you know, I think we were so lucky, both of us growing up in South Africa, being so exposed to actual wild spaces in a way that also living here, it's so clear to me that so many people here just never have that opportunity, specifically like kids who grow up in London, you know, especially in like less equipped areas. The UK in general is just such a kind of ecologically barren place that they don't understand what is missing. They have no sense of what is missing.
Sure, but then on the flip side of that coin, you also get, you know, groups forming to study the trees of London, for example, or moss colonies, or getting into the minutiae of what's left.
Yeah, exactly. I'm part of a
kind of cool.
Totally. I'm part of this little rewilding group in Hackney, obviously. And this guy, I love him so much. He's like, he's obsessed with newts, you know, like anything that you bring up, you know, you will be talking about putting in a wildflower meadow. And he's like, yeah, we should put in a wildflower meadow. At the bottom, there'll be a little bit of space. We can build a newt pond, you know, it brings everything around to the newts, which I love. But you talk to this guy and he is kind of single-handedly resurrected the population of a specific type of lizard that he once lived very commonly in the Lee Valley and then was kind of wiped out of that one local area and now is kind of thriving again because the concerted effort of a small group of people who felt passionately about newts and lizards did that work, you know, and now it has recovered. Apparently there are seals in the River Thames again.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Did not know this. They're orcas in Cape Town again.
That's amazing. Those bastards.
Livers.
Bastards. Wasn't there a thing that we didn't have any great white sharks for like 5 years in Cape Town?
The orcas chased them away and killed the few that weren't smart enough to get out of there. Jeez. And it's kind of weird because they would find great white sharks washed up dead with this incision where their liver was removed, but it looks like a surgeon's done it. They're not entirely sure how the orcas do this, but they just snack a liver and leave the rest of the shark.
Little bastard. I can't believe you don't think the ocean is terrifying, Simon. It's terrifying. There are orcas in there.
It's terrifying. It's also wild to think about what used to be in Europe. Like you watch Cave of Forgotten Dreams about the Lissau Caves in France.
France.
I don't know how to pronounce it. And, you know, if I remember correctly, it's like 40,000 years ago that these cave paintings date back to, and you know there's like rhinos in them in France. A species of furry rhinos that used to be running there. Crazy.
Wow. I one of the great books I read recently is this book called Wolfing, which looks at the efforts to resurrect wolf populations in the US, but also kind of the complexities of that, because obviously then they start, you know, killing little lambs and then farmers get quite mad.
Yeah, but also how the entire even sort of geography changes because of the reintroduction of an apex predator like that, right? So eventually you have river systems it's kind of being altered by, well, beavers essentially, but the beavers are there because X happened in this tree and it all goes back to the wolves. This I think we have discussed before. Except at the time, I actually knew what I was talking about and wasn't just rambling around the topic.
No, we definitely have. We definitely have. Yeah. But good. Okay. I'm very pleased. I'm very pleased with how well you did that challenge. Also, because I feel like I motivated you to go and have a swim in the ocean, and what a pleasure.
Yeah, and now you're motivating me to throw tomato soup at paintings. It's very exciting.
It's the only way.
Yeah. I mean, I tend towards optimism, which is perhaps a little bit naive. It's just like, I think we're going to solve this problem like we've solved so many before. And also, you know, like every single generation has one thing in common. They've all thought that the end of the world was nigh and that, you know, we had fucked the world up to a point beyond redemption and this was it. And the other thing they all had in common is that they were wrong. And things changed in some shitty ways sometimes. But ultimately, we're still here kicking ass and we've got more than enough food for now. So
no, I think
do with a little bit less conflict.
on a profound level, I absolutely agree with you. And I think specifically on the climate emergency, there's so much good news, right? Like the fact that renewable energy is now just cheaper, you know, like that it just kind of, it means that we're getting there. We're really getting there. I think it's just.
Plus, Sam, soon like, you'll be able to visit all of these wild spaces in VR on your MetaQuest your Apple Vision Pro. Cares? And so why do you need the real animals when you can have virtual ones that don't even need food?
Totally. Yeah, and I do think that the kind of nihilism of young people is also, it's a trap, right? Not only of young people, but the nihilism thing of, you know, oh, we're all dead, so why bother is also just it's a cheap out because I don't think it's accurate. But I do think, I think I'm just sad that ecosystems are being destroyed. Like, I don't think the world's going to end. But yeah.
Sure. No, I hear you. And it's interesting because, you know, you read... Bill Bryson's book, I'm trying to remember which one it was, where he talks about all of these species that are extinct that would have blown your mind if they were around today, like ground sloths, I think in South America, that were two stories high. Like they could literally look through the window of a two-story building.
That is a
and
nightmare.
Bears the size of houses in marsupial bears in where Australia now is. And what? Like, you know, those animals are extinct too.
Okay, I have a pitch for you. It's a new Godzilla movie spin-off, but it's Godzilla Sloth, and he's coming to attack the city, and good luckily one has several years to prepare because it takes a very long time.
Okay, which city are you directing the giant sloth to?
All of them. They're everywhere.
Who would I most like to see fucked up by a giant sloth? Probably like Moscow. It's never cities that really deserve it.
No.
We could do much better at this, Sam.
No. And then tugboats.
But I mean, this is also a topic that you thought very deeply about in developing your climate change game, which you'll excuse me, the name escapes me at the moment. I know that we've referred to it before in our show notes.
It's called Survive the Century. Thank you.
That's right. Survive the Century. Yeah. And it's amazing. Yeah. And so admittedly, this is not a topic that I know a hell of a lot about.
No, I mean, I think the thing is that like no one does, right? Because it affects everything. So I think this is why it's helpful to have people thinking about it from every background, right? Like I think there's huge potential solutions and huge ramifications thinking about financial systems, for example. So you do know a lot about a lot of things that are part of the problems is the thing, right?
Sure. But I think it's also one of those topics that gets a lot of people just throwing their hands in the air and going, this is too big for me to do anything about. Yeah. And it's too late anyway. And so I'm just going to enjoy what I can until, you know, the sun fries me every time I go outside.
That's what the freaking PR companies for British Petroleum are making us all think. We must not allow it to happen.
Yeah. So what are the, I mean, besides for playing your amazing game to learn more about this, because your game is kind of a choose your own adventure and a great introduction to the space. But I also wonder about like tactical, not necessarily activism, because I think a lot of people try and do a lot of things like using paper straws that are just fucking stupid. Yeah. Like, you know, 96% of the plastic in the ocean is fishing nets. So,
fishing,
you know,
you could
stick every straw in the world up Donald Trump's anus and it still wouldn't help.
Totally. I mean, so I think the best resource that I've found for learning more about the space is a podcast called All We Can Save, which I really, really love. That's kind of the best thing. And it's pitched at a really good level because it assumes that you are intelligent but not necessarily well-informed. Which I think is true for most of us, right? Like, because there's so much, as you say, like false information or disinformation, active disinformation in the space. But it's also, every time I listen to it, I don't feel hopeless. I feel like this is a complicated problem. It's complex, but it's not an impossible problem. And it is one of the things that I think was most helpful for me to get real clarity about what does help and what does matter. There's a book of essays that goes along with it as well, also called All We Can Save. Sorry, I lie. All We Can Save is only what the book is called. The podcast is called How to Save a Planet. Terrible. Uh-huh. That would be my number one suggestion, I think.
Okay, so All We Can Save is the book and How to Save a Planet is the podcast.
Correct.
Fantastic. I need new podcasts.
Yay.
I always need new podcasts.
Good. Yeah, you gave me some good podcast recommendations last time. I have started listening to some of them, but don't ask me now what any of them are. They've just been on shuffle.
I shan't. I'll ask you offline. Okay. I still feel that what the world needs is a podcast episode aggregator / recommendation system, which you and I have tried to design before.
Because
going, listen to this podcast, like Radiolab. Yeah. Cool. There are thousands of episodes. Where do you begin? It's very hit or miss. Some on topics you don't like, but it's actually individual episodes that you want surfaced to you, which currently only happens socially through friends. But it would be great to have a website where you could go, I'm really interested in chronoception and climate change and blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. And it would just go, well, I got you,
man.
He has a playlist of all the best episodes about that shit. Good luck with the rest of your life. And then that's the app I need in my life.
With some discussion stuff around it. Yeah, this is a thing that we have spoken about actually on and off for years. I wish someone would build this. Yeah. It might have to be us. Whew.
I have no more consumer products left in me, Sam. I'm done.
Are you done, bud? You're done.
No, I'm Captain B2B from here on in.
Yeah, man. No, we're making consumer apps. What a mug's game.
What an absolute mug's game. Yeah.
Do you have a challenge for me?
I do. My challenge to you, Sam, is I want you to find something practical in your life that's a problem that can be solved for a cost no greater than $50.
Okay.
So you could fix it using your time, but your time's expensive. I mean, I would venture that an hour of your time is worth way more than $50. So if it's going to take you longer than 15 minutes, then I'd argue it's too expensive. But you could maybe fix something by buying, you know, a thingy that costs $40. That fixes this problem that you just never get around to fixing.
I love this challenge. I feel like my life is full of problems.
Hey, man, don't let me stop you. Like, if you want to solve more than one, go for it.
Ooh, no, this is very good. This is very good. Because I feel like, so as you say this, this immediately kind of has me reflecting on what are those little friction points in my life that are annoying and probably they actually kind of add up to many lost hours of my life over my lifetime, but I could actually just solve them, which is a great
challenge. So now you see where I'm going with this.
Yeah. I'm also immediately thinking, like, what are the things that I do frequently that I can automate that I don't love doing? Oh, okay. I love it. Can it be cheaper than
more than $50?
$50. That's the top. If I can,
it can
fix
be
it
free.
For free.
Free is fine too. But if you tell me you spent 4 hours doing it, sorry, that's not free. In fact,
that's a good limit.
Yeah, more than 15 minutes feels like more than $50 of Sam's time.
You
short.
No, this is great. I feel like I also spend so much time railing. I think I kind of am too far in the spectrum of like, you can't just buy things to solve your problems. And I'm very freaking like Captain DIY in a way that is often, you know, actually insane if I think about it, where I do end up spending like 30 hours fixing something that I could have actually just bought a thing and it would have actually solved my problem. So this is actually a very good challenge specifically for me.
That, and I've also been realizing that people spend a lot of time deliberating about their big problems. You know, it's like I'm the house I'm living in, the relationship I'm in, the car I'm driving, the job I have, the, you know, those are what people spend time thinking about fixing while they have this plethora of like little things that irritate them for a few minutes every day that they do fuck nothing about.
I love this. Okay, solutions.
And by them, I mean me.
I'm a solutions gal. Okay, I love it. That is an excellent challenge. I'm going to reflect on that.
Well, I look forward to your feedback.
Right, I'm going to think about it. Has there been anything else in your life that's just generally given you joy recently?
Awesome things. I've been thinking a lot about a game called Palworld that I can't talk about because I haven't been playing it, but I would encourage you to look at it. It's Pokemon with guns. Our friend Kenneth has been playing it, so has my son. It's broken records on Steam for most concurrent game played online or whatever. So that could be, that's one I've been meaning to look into. On our topic from last week of games, there are a whole list of them that I need more of in my life. Other than that, not so much. Hey, I've just been working, so I haven't been checking out new things. Mm. Although I'll say this, I have been watching a show on Netflix called Love on the Spectrum.
Which I'm obsessed. It makes me weep. Weep. It's so beautiful.
I will admit to weeping too. It really is beautiful. And it's one of those things that I dismissed when somebody first told me about it because, I mean, it's basically like a dating show for people on the spectrum, which to me, when I was first told about it, sounded like, you know, these people were being put out there to be made fun of and to be laughed at. And it felt like disability porn to me. Mm. But when you watch it, you realize it's completely not that at all.
It's so
and
wholesome.
It's incredibly touching and beautiful and gives you an insight into these people's realities in a way that you don't get otherwise.
Mm. Absolutely.
So been loving that little slice of reality television.
And let's be honest, did you or did you not get low-key obsessed with Love Island, Simon? Do you or do you not actually have a secret?
I get pulled into it by the people around me every so often.
Yeah, sure.
I draw the line at the borders of the UK, though. I am not going to watch Australian Love Island or USA Love Island.
Sure, Simon. Someone
but I will clap the occasional episode
of... Sorry, we'll watch the occasional episode of what?
What are your awesome things that you found this week, Sam?
Well, my favorite recent dating show is a show called I Kissed a Boy. Kylie Minogue is in it, and I'm obsessed. Anyway, no. I think unrelated to dating shows. Actually, I've done something recently which connects back to an old conversation we had on the show, which was the Wim Hof one, which is finally, after all this time, they've recently opened a community sauna, community bathhouse thing near my house, and it has a cold water immersion pool. So last night, we went and we saunaed some friends, and then afterwards, I jumped into an ice bath, and oh my goodness, it is the most pure euphoria I think I remember ever feeling. It was just actually very magical in a way that I cannot properly understand or articulate. And you did tell me, and you were right. You were right. It's damn good. Also, just
and something that can be done in the waters of Cape Town any time of the day or night.
For free. You might find some little sycophants while you're in there. But it was also just kind of really magic. There's been a lot of talk in the UK recently about how, or at least in London, about how we do winter wrong here because we try so hard to make it not be winter. And there's kind of been this recent move around embracing wintering and wintering in a more of a Scandinavian way, which, you know, they kind of will go up to a little log cabin and then go and jump in a lake. And there's been this whole new thing trend here, really, of people opening up these very rustic winter cabins in near the lochs in Scotland and with a little sauna, and then you go and jump in the cold loch afterwards. And people just saying, like, actually just lean in, like, the season is what it is. And I've been kind of trying to take that to heart a little bit. And last night was really just magical. And I think partly also just sitting in a dark room with a fire, just with some friends, just felt so cozy. We started singing, which also felt very Scandinavian. And then jumped in a very cold pond and it felt so life-giving. It was really, really lovely. So
yeah. Of the many things that separate the UK from Europe, its inability to cope with winter is definitely near the top of the list.
We're such wusses. Just can't.
Yeah, and you go to a place like Stockholm, you know, in the middle of winter, as I did, where I think we had 2 hours of sunlight the one day. And of course, I'd stayed long enough, it would have gone down to zero. Not temperature-wise, hours of sunlight-wise, I mean. and you just see how incredibly jacked they are and ready they are for this and, like, seasoned at dealing with it in a way that the United Kingdom just doesn't even remotely resemble.
Yeah, it sounds so much healthier. I think there is just a general piece of wisdom in there as well about just, you know, be where you are, don't fight it, you know.
Yeah. All right, anything else?
That's it. It has been very nice to see your city.
It's a very short list of awesome things this week from you, Sammy. Yeah. But you have been busy. You've just handed in your novel, so that's done.
My edits, yeah.
We spoke about that briefly last week.
Oh my god! But it is the endless thing of I pushed hard, I finished it, I handed it in, and then immediately, you know, one day later, got some feedback, and they were like, "Yeah, this is great. Here's how we think we should rewrite the last act. So when you're ready, go back into edits again." I'm like, never ends. But yeah, sometimes just things just take the time they take, I guess. So I'm taking a little break from it, but I will need to go back into edits in a couple of weeks.
Well, good luck with that, friend.
Thanks. It has started to feel like a book, at least. It's still a bad book, but now at least it feels like a book. And
well, I'll be the judge of that. Thank you very much, young lady.
No, I think that is a thing. Like, I think all writers, all creative people of any sorts, including entrepreneurs, you have to kind of make the bad first version of something. And that's really hard, just letting yourself make the bad first version so that you can then better version.
I find it harder to let go of a final, in inverted commas, version. It's something that Neil Gaiman speaks very eloquently about. Well, I mean, he speaks very eloquently about everything because he's Neil Gaiman, but he famously, in one of his talks, talks about like just having to let it out there at some point. Like, you just have to let go. It has to, it's not finished. It's never going to be finished, but at some point you just need to put it out there.
Just to launch it into the world. Yeah. Don't you have a son who's just about to go to university? Doesn't this all feel very thematic?
Yes. And I had nothing to do with it. Well, I mean, I was there at inception, but other than that.
Such a lie. You're such a good dad, you fool. Don't fool me. I know you too well. I guess like the only other, I think kind of on that note, that does make me think of another lovely thing recently, which is the latest Miyazaki movie, The Boy and the Heron. I've been listening to the soundtrack a lot, and I'm utterly obsessed with it. I think it's marvelous. But as a film, I think really thematically what it's grappling with, what it feels like it's grappling with, is Miyazaki as a director and kind of coming to the end of his career and what it feels like to choose to stop making movies, you know? And that sense of this isn't just a thing he could hand off to someone else to continue doing. It's a part of him, and he's finished now, and it's over. It's very moving. It's very, very moving.
Okay, I've added it to the list. Oh, actually, that reminds me. There is another film I watched lately, Vengeance. BJ Novak's film, wrote, directed, acted in. Have you seen this thing?
No, but I love BJ Novak. Tell me everything.
I mean, it's been out for a while now. It's a 2022 film. It slipped by me. So I watched this last week. And I mean, it's what you'd expect from BJ Novak. It's very strange and delightful. By far the greatest role that Ashton Kutcher's ever played is in that film.
Oh, really?
Highly recommend.
Better than that prank show. His role on that prank show.
Yeah. A little bit different from Punked.
Do you know BJ Novak wrote probably my favorite children's book of all time, which is called The Book with No Pictures? He's famous from The Office, I think, is kind of the thing he's best known for. But he's just so funny. He's really a gem. That sounds great. I'll definitely give that a watch.
You've given me many things for my list this week, Sammy.
The Book with No Pictures is great. The thing to do is not, it's to buy the book, but it's kind of, the book works as a prank on the adult who has to read the book out loud, is kind of how it functions. So actually the best way to interact with it is to just watch a video of BJ Novak reading that book to a bunch of small children. It is, or to even better, yourself read that book to small children. They cackle. They think it is the funniest thing they've ever seen. It's so wholesome and good.
Awesome. Can't wait to check it out.
Yeah. It's a very pure thing being laughed at by small children.
It is one I do not get to enjoy often enough. But every time I see my nieces who live in another city, they do nothing but laugh at me. So,
Uncle Simon.
Uncle Simon, yes, correct. Or Poop Face, or Mister, or whatever they decide to call me that week.
Oh, so good.
All right, my love. I need to go into some late meetings about commercial ventures.
Lame. Enjoy.
Super lame. I'd much rather be doing this.
I'm going to try and tackle my nightmare of an inbox, but what a damn pleasure to see your face.
Well, you know, your commitment to doing this more often is holding up pretty well. We've made it to 2, so this year.
It's already double our annual average, and it's only January. I'm very excited about my challenge.
I can't wait to hear what you come up with.
Okay, buddy.
Okay, love you.
Love you. Bye.
Bye. Oh.